Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. Last week, we heard from Gloria Edom, founder of the Well-Read Black Girl Book Club. This week, AWM Program Director Allison Sansoni chats with writer and historian Catherine Arnold about her recent book, Pandemic 1918, Eyewitness Accounts from the Greatest Medical Holocaust in Modern History. This conversation took place May 26, 2020, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
We're grateful to all of you for being here and for valuing the past, present, and future of thoughtful reading and writing. The stories of history can teach us a lot about how to live in the present and plan for the future. And perhaps no era in our history is more instructive to us right now than 1918, when contagion ravaged the world, shuttering schools, closing businesses, and killing hundreds of thousands. Here to talk with us about what became known 102 years ago as the Spanish flu is Catherine Arnold, who pored over years of eyewitness accounts of the illness from its early beginnings at places like a military base in Kansas to its effects on a number of prominent American writers like John Steinbeck and Catherine Ann Porter. She read English at the University of Cambridge and holds a further degree in psychology. Catherine is the author of several books about the history of London, and her book Globe, The World of Shakespeare's London, was published by Simon & Schuster in 2015. She's joining us today from the UK. Welcome, Catherine. Welcome. Thank you for being here with us. You know, in telling the story of this disease, you focused on first-person accounts from doctors, nurses, from children all over the world. Why did you choose to take such a personal view of the pandemic?
I wanted to write a book that people could relate to. I wanted to write a book about Spanish flu where people could read it and find characters like themselves. At times, it was almost like a disaster movie. You know, you've got people stuck on the Titanic or whatever. The full spectrum of human personality types and people that's, you know, there's somebody in this book that you can relate to who's very close to your own experience, whether it's because of their age or their gender or their religious background. So many people got caught up in this. And of course, you know, 100 million people died. It was also because there were books about Spanish flu around at the time, excuse me, when I was proposing mine. But they tended to be largely academic, so they're very much written by academics for academics or for students. So they looked at, strictly speaking, the medical side of it, or the, well, the epidemiology, or even the geographical side, or the economic consequences, but less so about the lives of people involved. And because I've been a novelist, well, still am, and because I've been a feature writer on a big broadsheet, a big regional daily, it was important for me to really bring it alive and just to tell readers that these were living, breathing, suffering people just like yourselves.
In the book's opening pages, you say it's hard to imagine a similar scenario. You know, schools shuttered, morgues and hospitals overwhelmed, cities coping with hundreds of dead and dying today. Do you still feel that way, or are we seeing history repeat itself in front of our eyes?
It's very salutary. When I was writing it, I had no idea that we would have another pandemic. For one thing, I've been reassured by various sources that such a thing would not overwhelm us in the same way, but I'll get back to that in a moment. What was curious for me while I was writing it was a day like this, you know, beautiful spring day, a nice street in a suburb, everything seeming absolutely marvellous. And I just thought, suppose it was like this in a street in a suburban area of maybe Chicago or Philadelphia. Somebody's just sitting there writing. Somebody's daughter is saying, hey, your next lot of books have arrived. Do you want to unpack them? And then suddenly, out of nowhere, this terrible thing strikes and people in the streets start getting sick and dying more and more every day. Well, to imagine a scenario like that would have been like imagining a horror story. As I wrote, I took comfort in what I knew, which was I'd been told that on both sides of the Atlantic, preparations had been made to deal with just such a pandemic. It's true to say that in some ways in this country, they've handled it comparatively well with lockdown. But I thought there was far more in the way of government control standing between us and total annihilation. And I'm realising now that there's less of that, unfortunately. Of course, the big difference now is numbers. Coronavirus has been terrible, and it has killed, I think, around 250,000 worldwide. It's killed nearly 100,000 in the States, but nothing like the scale of 1918 when, you know, 100 million people lost their lives, an almost inconceivable number. 550,000 people in the States died. That was more than the losses in the First World War. And of course, the symptoms are different, but we can get on to that. So this is a little taste for us of, this is kind of like a mini pandemic compared with what we went through 100 years ago. We are getting some indication of the colossal existential crisis that people faced. That real feeling that we haven't had for generations, that our lives were at risk from something that was normal. You know, we live, all of us, with the knowledge that sooner or later we have to die and that we will lose people we love, but it's quite a big shock suddenly to be told you could lose your nearest and dearest, or your own health is at risk if you step outside your front door. That's something that it's taken a lot of getting used to, and I think younger people, the so-called millennial generation, have really struggled with it.
Your previous works of history focused on the city of London, on members of the royal family. How did you become fascinated with this disease?
Well, my previous books, apart from the Edward VII one, which was a bit of light entertainment, my previous books about London were all about the dark side of London, the steamy underbelly, death and burial, madness and the treatment of mental health, capital punishment, the sex industry. But they were centred on London. And because I'd written about the dark side of London, I thought it seems natural to me to do a book on Spanish flu in London. So at first I looked at that with my agent, but as we kind of discussed it and I began to investigate it, it became obvious to me that perhaps I better do a book about Spanish flu in Britain. But then we realised that it was a global thing, and the best way to approach it was to attempt to write about it globally. In structural terms, this had its own problems in terms of creating a narrative. That was one of the reasons I used so many eyewitness accounts. Because Spanish flu, like all pandemics, it was going on in a lot of places at the same time. It didn't sort of do a simple narrative arc from one place, China, over to the United States. It was literally all over the place. And trying to come up with a narrative for it was like trying to nail jelly to the wall. So that was quite time consuming. But it was also, there's a personal connection, because my father was a great deal older than my mother, and he'd lost both his parents to Spanish flu in the last year of World War I. So there was kind of an interest in this terrible thing that had happened in my family, meaning that I had no family at all on his side. Nothing. No, I met nobody. And the fact that he wouldn't talk about it made it even more intriguing. And it kind of hung over my childhood like a dark pall. So it became something significant to me to write about. I had sort of a score to settle almost.
Yeah. What was your research process like, particularly in the U.S.? Where did you find reliable information, and how did you go about getting access to it?
Some of it was already there. Some of it, PBS made a brilliant series about 30 years ago where they interviewed last surviving people who'd had Spanish flu or lived through it. Obviously, most of those people have passed on by now. So that was a useful source. I also looked at people's memoirs. I thought, well, I'll look at the memoir, the background of anybody notable who's lived through that period. So I did that. And the birds have started tapping again. I also looked into newspaper records, because obviously online now, there are some great newspaper resources where if you've got kind of the patience to plough through them, you can find useful material and anecdotes. And also I looked at the more academic books where people have, for instance, written learned articles about Spanish flu in Alaska, or investigations into trying to find the infected tissue, the infected DNA of people who died of Spanish flu. And some of those investigations took place in Canada and Alaska as well. So a number of sources, and in the UK, quite a lot from the Imperial War Museum, which proved useful.
You mentioned that more people died from this flu than from World War One, but World War One was an important vector in moving the disease all over the world. Tell us a little bit about the role of troop movements and how that influenced the way that the disease spread.
World War One was terrifically influential, partly for the way it spread the disease and partly for the way that the disease wasn't tackled with the same vigor as people are trying to tackle coronavirus now. So while Spanish flu would probably have spread globally, inevitably, over time, World War One really speeded up the process because you've got, for instance, troop ships going from the US over to Europe to fight in France and back again. On a larger scale, you've got troop ships from the Allies and the Germans going around the world to places like Cape Town and Bombay and taking it with them. The only place that successfully kept it out until January 1919 was Australia, where they had a very vigorous attitude towards quarantine, which was only relaxed after the end of the war when it got in the January of 1919 and around about 9,000 Aussies lost their lives to it. But if you think of the war, it turned the globe into a giant Petri dish, really, with the flu just being spread around in every conceivable way. When it wasn't spread by troops, inadvertently, and troop ships like the Leviathan, it was also spread by public transport and in the US by the Postal Service. One researcher was trying to work out why Native Alaskans and Native Americans were dying in their hundreds, and it turned out it was because the Postal Service was still getting through to them, and it was inadvertently, without their knowing, spread by the guys who were delivering the mail.
Yeah.
My other point about was just that because it was such a huge and fundamentally vital event, all the focus really went on winning the war rather than stopping the virus.
Well, the war also played a role in news about the virus having been, you know, suppressed or downplayed. Why would that have happened, and what effect did it have?
That was mostly a question of morale. To start off with, certainly in the UK, if a newspaper delved too deeply into reports of this strange new killer flu that had come in the summer and was killing people, it would have been suppressed by something called DORA, or the Defence of the Realm Act. Other ways of devaluing it or making it seem trivial were to make it an object of ridicule, which happened with the London Times in June, when they just suggested that people who had Spanish flu were just being affected and they should just man up and get on with it. In September in the US, when Spanish flu was making a bold return after dying back in the summer, again, the military authorities were saying, well, yeah, okay, but it's not that bad, really. Brushing it under the carpet, because the last thing you wanted was the men panicking because other guys were dying on their base and all around them. And you didn't want a collapse of morale, particularly in the States, where possibly certain people could use it to their own ends and say, I should have told you we should never have entered the war. You know, look, our guys are dying. There's kind of a way in which you can understand why they were trying to control information and suppress it. But at the same time, to a historian and to somebody who wants to get at the truth, then it's frustrating because people deserved to have known what was going on. And of course, it got to the point where you couldn't really deny that this was happening, because every newspaper in the United States was carrying these huge banner headlines in 90 point with huge death tolls.
The disease also had a profound effect on some prominent American writers. In your book, you mention Thomas Wolfe, John Steinbeck, Mary McCarthy. We mentioned Catherine Ann Porter. Tell us a little bit about what they went through and how it affected their writing.
Sure. What's interesting about them is that there weren't more. only those four writers and the humorist James Thurber. Those were the sort of preeminent people I could find in the States who'd gone through it or knew of it. It's quite surprising that as a phenomenon, it wasn't written over and written about and mythologized the way the war was. In Catherine Ann Porter's case, she was a journalist in Colorado on the Rocky Mountain News. And she was divorced, single gal, lived on coffee and cigarettes so she could spend all her money on clothes. And she was living in lodgings when she became ill. And her landlady took one look at her and threw her out. So then Catherine turned to her editor for help, and he managed to find her a hospital bed, without which she would probably have died. And even as Catherine was lying in hospital, behind the screens, hearing the doctors talk about her and giving up on her, her colleagues back at the Rocky Mountain News were setting her obituary in type. I can, you know, as an ex-journalist, it just makes me shudder to think of that. She pulled through, but she was violently ill, and when she was recovering, she tried to get out of bed and broke her arm. And then she had one of the other distinctive things that happens to you with Spanish flu, which is her hair turned white overnight. And it never grew back to its natural colour. She had to dye it black for the rest of her life. But Catherine had a lucky escape, and she took the attitude, and she says about this in Pale Rider, her memoir, it really made me decide what I needed to do. You know, I'd been a bit of a lightweight up till now, but I decided if I was going to be a writer, I should jolly well get on with it. So she had a good outcome. She did sadly lose her then lover in the flu. Mary McCarthy suffered really badly. When news of the flu began, Mary was about 9 years old, and her folks decided, right, we're going to go back home to, I think it's Minneapolis. We're going to go back to the Midwest anyway, from Seattle. And her father was a bit of a wastrel. He was a playboy. He was always broke. On the train, they soon became sick. And the conductor wanted to throw them off the train at a station in the middle of the prairie. So to Mary's astonishment, her father pulled a gun on the conductor. And he sort of, strongest moment ever of his life, he sort of said, well, I'd like to see you try. But they died, and Mary's grandparents were there to meet her at the station when the train arrived. She never saw her parents again, and she was brought up by very cold, distant relatives. I'm sure they were just trying to do their best. But she said it changed the course of her life, because she said if she'd stayed in Seattle, she'd have just been sort of a normal middle-class Catholic woman. She'd have married a lawyer, she'd have belonged to a book club, and that would have been it. But as it was, she went off and became this firebrand intellectual author and contributor to the New Yorker. So I think it did change the course of her life. And finally, briefly, John Steinbeck caught Spanish flu, nearly lost a lung, recovered, but he was always a bit strange afterwards. One of the common threads was that quite often Spanish flu survivors had medical problems for the rest of their lives, and a common one was depression. And it's said that he suffered from this and nervous diseases in both senses of the word. and Thomas Wolfe, in Look Homeward, Angel, he writes a thinly disguised account of losing his brother, who again was kind of a wastrel, sort of a man who hadn't done much with his life, but The description of his gradual decline and death is absolutely heartrending. And it's a very good piece of American Gothic as well. It's a very outstanding piece of writing. But you would have thought, given that this is a nation, you know, that's produced so many other great writers, that especially in that generation, that there would have been more about Spanish flu.
Yeah. I was struck by the way that it seemed to have disappeared from, you know, from the collective cultural memory. And I was wondering if you had thoughts on why that was.
Yes, I think it was because it was just so horrible. There's one writer I quote in the book whose name escapes me at the moment, might come to me, but he subsequently went on to become the literary editor of The New Yorker and indeed worked with Mary McCarthy. And he said after his mother, an unborn sibling, died, the world just changed for him forever. Something was lost. There was a kind of sadness which never went away. And I think because the symptoms were so ghastly, so grotesque, the loss was so harrowing, that this was simply something people could not deal with on top of the war. It was one thing, it was common enough in those days to know that your menfolk would go away to the war and possibly not come back. That was unpleasant, but kind of culturally acceptable. But to lose people at home in bed from this monstrous disease was a whole lot more difficult to deal with, especially when, say, in Europe, people have already lived through 4 years of it. In the States, they'd had the run-up to it and the anxiety of seeing all their young men march off to France. So this was just the final straw after a long and painful experience of war. And I think that's one of the reasons people do not want to remember it.
In reading the book, I was struck by, you know, a number of parallels to today, but the one I found most interesting was that when the disease really did take hold and people started to say, all right, we need to socially isolate, people need to wear masks, there was some resistance to that, correct?
Correct, yes. And this is quite late on, really, in the pandemic, because in January 1919, we have what is called the third wave, because this flu, like certain other things, and we hope not the coronavirus, please God, it came in waves. So it would come big onslaught, then it would die back and then return again, even worse. So the third wave was raging away in San Francisco in January 1919. And the mayor of San Francisco, Rolf, I believe, said to citizens, right, from now on, if you go out, you have to wear a mask. Mask wearing is mandatory, even though legally it wasn't enforceable. The police had orders to arrest anybody who was seen out without a mask. Now, most people were happy to comply because they'd already lived through the worst of it, and the last thing they wanted was to go back to the kind of conditions they witnessed in September and November. However, as always, there's always a group of people who don't agree. And in this case, they started something called the Anti-Mask League. And this group was composed of physicians, libertarians, and cranks. So they had a meeting. We're not told whether this maybe took place outside because that would have been safer. They had a meeting, and the more kind of sensible ones said, well, what we should do is we should do petition and send it to the mayor saying we don't agree with this mask wearing, please just don't make it compulsory. But of course the more radical ones were like, no, this is unconstitutional, this is against our rights, this is not what it is to be an American, we don't want to wear these darn masks. And this rumbled on for several weeks, and then at one point an improvised explosive device was sent to the public health offices in San Francisco, and it contained something like 3 pounds of gunpowder and some shot and an alarm clock. So you can imagine what would have happened if it had been detonated. Mercifully, it wasn't. But soon afterwards, the mayor said, right, okay, next council meeting, we're going to say masks are no longer going to be compulsory. But he did add this sort of caveat that if we lift the mask regulation, you do realise, don't you, that the death toll is going to rise. And everybody was like, yeah, so. And within about 10 days of getting rid of masks being compulsory, 300 people died of Spanish flu. So, yes, of course, there are parallels with particularly the scenes in Michigan some weeks ago when people were calling for the governor to be murdered. I think those are every bit as extreme as sending an IED to the government offices.
The coronavirus that we're currently dealing with has had serious outbreaks in prisons, in prison populations. And the 1918 flu had this much the same scenario. There was a doctor there who you quote in the book, Dr. Stanley, who, you know, had a very controversial approach, you know, in some cases horrifying approach to the disease. Can you tell us a little bit about how it proceeded through the prisons?
Well, just briefly, I think the most shocking aspect of this was that Dr. Stanley used his prison as as an experiment to see how easily his male prisoners would catch influenza virus. So he would deliberately put infected men in a recreation room in the prison with people who were not infected. Stanley was notorious, though. He later conducted a number of grotesque experiments, which I can't go into in too much detail, but involved castrating various people and giving their castrated genitals to other prisoners to see if this would change their levels of hormones. So it's not for the squeamish. But I think it was the unethical nature of this. I mean, obviously prisons like schools and like barracks or military bases were places where everybody was crammed in close together. And obviously the contagion could spread swiftly. But I think Dr. Stanley is a supreme example of somebody taking advantage of the kind of natural experimental qualities of the disease and just exploiting them.
Well, I want to ask you what lessons you feel that 1918 can teach us. What do you think we can learn from, particularly from this in our current moment?
It's a good question. I think the main thing that we've learned is to throw everything at it, which obviously they weren't able to do in World War One because the main focus was on winning the war. I think we've learned a lot in terms of the value of social distancing, mask wearing, if you need to, quarantine and general hygiene. Personally, I think people have become a lot more supportive and friendly to each other in the main. On the street level, people who live in the same neighbourhoods and communities have been overwhelmingly supportive of each other. But at national level, obviously, in my country and in yours, there's been a lot of political unrest and uncertainty about the way the authorities are handling it. I think we've learned more to trust science. In those days, of course, there was very little scientifically that they knew about influenza. They realised that it was spread from person to person and it was highly contagious. But they were only just coming to terms with the idea of a virus. The electron microscope was not invented until the 1930s. And of course, there's no vaccine. The first flu vaccine wasn't developed until about 1938. What we're doing now, obviously, is we've got scientists who are working night and day to try and develop a vaccine, although, of course, they may never do so. And it may be that we have to live with this awful virus for the next, rest of my lifetime, probably, and mask up and gown up against it. I think we've learnt, as I said, to make it our focus because we're not involved in a massive global conflict. And I think we've learned a lot about being more patient. I'm always amazed by the amount of people I know who will comply with the rules. And if they're told, stay at home, queue up at the supermarket, wear a mask, they do so because they realise the importance of not just looking after themselves, but their communities and their loved ones. So I think those are the take-home lessons.
Thank you very much for your insights and for the book itself. And Catherine, thank you very much for being here with us. Thank you, everyone, for coming. We've enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, we chat with Pulitzer Prize winner and global energy expert Daniel Yergin about his recent book, The New Map, Energy, Climate, and the Clash of Nations. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.